This is Nachyomi, Sefer Shemuel Aleph, Chapter 2. This chapter opens with the famous Tefillat Chana, the prayer of thanksgiving that Chana recited after being blessed with a child and bringing him to the Mishkan to leave him there for his entire life. The prayer reflects on the instability of human fortune and emphasizes that only the Creator ultimately determines our fate. It concludes with a request that the enemies of Hashem be decimated and that true leaders, specifically a chosen king of Israel, be uplifted and strengthened. The sons of Eli are well known for their insensitivity, unabashed corruption, and mafia-style tactics of managing the affairs of the sanctuary at Shiloh. They demand more of the sacrificial animal's flesh than they are entitled. Even more, they refuse to show the slightest deference to the sanctity of the religious services going on there. They won't even wait until the rituals are completed before partaking of the meat. When their instructions are not heeded, they take whatever they want by brute force. Rumors swirl that they've even engaged in inappropriate behaviors with the women who come to bring sacrifices to the sanctuary. Needless to say, the sons of Eli have a terrible reputation in Israel and are the object of a lot of animosity and resentment. They are a prime example of desecration of Hashem's name, Chilul Hashem, because they are giving people a terrible impression of the service of Hashem. It comes across as just another way to make money, to advance oneself, to satisfy one's lusts. The religion of the sons of Eli has nothing to do with Kiddusha, nothing to do with inspiration, nothing to do with holiness, or anything of eternal value. In the meantime, Shemuel grows in his knowledge and devotion to Hashem, as well as his popularity among the people. His parents visit him still on a yearly basis, and his mother Chana brings him clothing and other gifts. She's repeatedly blessed by Eli HaKohen for her selfless contribution to the future of the Jewish people in giving Shemuel, so to speak, to the service of God. And she has five more children after Shemuel. Eli HaKohen makes a feeble and unsuccessful attempt at trying to rebuke his sons and correct their behavior, but not surprisingly, they're already very much set in their ways and his words have no effect. They fall on deaf ears. A prophet visits Eli and informs him that because his sons have brought such shame upon the Kehuna, upon the priesthood of Israel, and upon Hashem and the institution of the Beit HaMikdash, the institution of the sanctuary, that his descendants are going to be cursed with short lifespans and severe poverty. The two sons of Eli are destined to die on the very same day and to be replaced ultimately by a trustworthy and honorable Kohen who will restore dignity to the office of the priesthood and the institution of the temple, and of course the Torah itself, which the sons of Eli have not been teaching. There is much to comment upon in this chapter, but just for the sake of brevity, we'll focus on one angle here. The prayer of Chana is often misunderstood as being essentially unrelated to the content of her story. Somebody reads Tefillat Chana could read it any time. It's in the beginning of the Siddur. It's something that seems to have a generic kind of quality to it. It can be applied to almost any situation of suffering followed by deliverance. So some scholars, and even rabbis, for example, the very well-known scholar of Tanakh, Rabbi Yitzchak Etz Shalom, whose shiurim I enjoy very much, have suggested that it was a generic hymn that people would recite on occasions of salvation and deliverance, and that really it didn't have anything to do with Chana's particular circumstances. She just happened to recite it on this occasion, and it became known as Tefillat Chana, but it was something of a more general nature that she herself may not have even composed. Our understanding of the introduction to the book of Shemuel, however, leads us to exactly the opposite conclusion. The greatness of Chana was precisely that she saw the universal significance in her particular story. It makes perfect sense that her thanksgiving ode to Hashem would reflect the broad principles she felt were exemplified by her plight and Hashem's answer to her prayer, and that she wouldn't be bogged down with the details of her personal life or incorporate them into the song that she sung. Because she rose above the limitations of her own family drama and diagnosed the spiritual illness of the whole nation, she took the bold steps that actually resolved the crisis in the end. In her prayer, she presents us with a big picture perspective on divine providence and how it operates in people's lives, the limits of human artifice and human agenda and human power. And she also expresses her hope that the actions she has taken will eventuate in the establishment of a stable and successful monarchy in the land of Israel, which she understands, she realizes, is the ingredient that's missing that would make true success, true growth, and a true achievement of the divine purpose of the Jewish people possible. So rather than dwell upon the details of what happened to her, her focus has shifted completely to the problems of the Jewish people and their ultimate solution.